HRN has a brand new look, but we're sharing the same delicious stories. Invest in the future of food radio by becoming a monthly sustaining member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host here on Beer Sessions Radio. And big shout out to HRN, Heritage Radio Network, has a great new website at heritageradionetwork.org and a new branding. So we're really excited about that going on our 12th year now as Beer Sessions Radio. So it's July 6th, 2021, Tuesday. We're recording remotely. And I wanted to talk about generally summer beers, beer and food pairing. But with some of the experts we got on the show, we're going to go a little deeper. In fact, we might touch on nose to tail and some other what I find interesting culinary things to talk about. So let's go through and introduce our guests quickly. Start with Angela.
Yeah, hi there. Just a little bit about maybe what I'm doing right now or... So my background?
A little bit about your background, because you're quite the food and beer pairing expert.
Yeah, that's the thing. I've done so many different things. I just love pairing. So when it comes to cigars or cheeses or dinners, food in general, pairing it with beer, it is a huge passion point for me. So I've been very lucky to be able to manage various beer programs, pairing programs, working on the floor as a Cicerone, putting together even a community college program, especially centered around beer and food pairings. I've been able to do classes, virtual, of course, and in person for years. And it's just been a great joy of my life. So it's really exciting to be able to talk about that today. Also mentioned, I used to be a draft tech, but food and beer pairings are definitely, again, the big passion
point. Yeah, and we're going to talk a lot with you tonight. And also to note, weren't you one of the youngest advanced Cicerones?
Certified Cicerone. Yeah, that's so funny. Wow, God, 7 years ago now. When I was 21, yes, I was able to pass that exam pretty much just after I turned 21. So that was able to help me get launched into the industry, and I've just been kind of going from there. No, but also, yes, an advanced Cicerone now.
You're great. You worked your way up from Michigan to New York, and we've got a lot to talk to you about. Emre, give us an intro, please.
Hi, I'm Emery Woods. I'm the founder of Right Side Brewing. We're a non-alcoholic beer line out of Atlanta, Georgia. And I have been in beverage for about 5 years now, and we just launched in January. So I'm excited to talk to y'all today.
Great. Thank you. And Richard, I want to give him the intro. When we first started talking about summer food and beer pairings, I wanted to have Chef Richard Knight join us. But then we realized that he's part of this lineage of nose-to-tail chefs that has been inspired by Fergus Henderson. So, Richard, give us a quick intro about yourself beyond that.
Okay. Yes, I'm obviously English, been here 25 years. I've worked around London, also down in the South Coast. Came over to the Americas, I believe you call it, and got famous in Houston, Texas for a fully on nose-to-tail restaurant called Feast, which got a lot of national recognition and New York Times and all those things, just because we were doing something sort of a little bit very, very different for Houston and America in general at the time. So that was sort of 2008 to 2013, and then I've been doing some other restaurant stuff since then, down here in Houston.
So Richard, you know, and now like a lot of the events that I do in New York, like the Brisket King and Pig Island have kind of become more barbecue centered. But in the beginning, it was more about nose to tail cooking and farm to table. How did you get influenced by Fergus Henderson? And tell us a little bit about who he is for those of us who don't know.
Fergus Henderson has a couple of places in London, St. John's and Bread and Wine, I believe. It got very famous probably 20 years ago, maybe now. He was the first sort of godfather who brought back all these old recipes and thought about doing it old school, of absolutely going nose to tail, you know, noses, ears, head, eyeballs, you know, you name it. He would cook it. And doing it in a very simplistic form. He was actually trained as an architect. And so you can kind of see that in his food. It's very simple, but very beautiful and very thought about. And he became this giant phenomena. And then a lot of other chefs followed suit going, oh, wow. And this is what it should be like. This is what people should be doing. This is what people in the rest of the world have been doing for thousands of years, like in South America and Asia and you know, parts of Europe and everywhere, basically. And that sort of got lost in sort of translation through the years, even in England to a certain extent, until Fergus sort of brought this resurgence back. And then, you know, obviously you had a little bit of a thing in America, but it was a bit more of a hard push here in a lot of ways.
But then he also helped people start reconsidering that English food did have a really good heritage, right?
Well, thank God for that, eh? Yes. No, he did. And he was one of the great pioneers of the Renaissance of English cooking and being, you know, I suppose, respected again in the world for our culinary. You know, it became obviously a bit of a big butt joke, you know, for a long time about English food. And there is some bad food in England. Yes, there is, but there's some bad food in most countries.
Richard, how did that translate to you cooking in Houston and at Feast?
Well, we had, me and my ex-partner, James Silk, we had a little place before that, but which was didn't work out, but it was a good, nice sort of dress rehearsal. And I didn't actually directly work for Fergus. James did, and he was doing front of house, and then he was doing some starting just because he was interested in it. I was the trained chef, and James wasn't, but he got into front of house stuff. And he worked under and just did starging. You know, he would sit behind the sink cleaning pig's ears for 5 hours, you know, just for no money, just for the experience. And so he was trying to get Houston and get his green card so we could open a restaurant. And because I had sort of the culinary background and he had some of the other St. John kind of stuff going on that he knew about and loved, we sort of made this beautiful thing. Yeah, Feast, we absolutely down the line, and we only dealt with farmers we knew. We only dealt with, you know, animals and farms we knew. We knew the pigs were rolling around in the sunshine. The pigs were, you know, rolling around in mud. We knew where the chickens were running around, and we did everything from, you know, even the cases of stuff that we got in occasionally, which is obviously very rarely we would get case of it. But we knew that it was happy animals from good farms and good farmers that were doing things properly. All the fish we got locally from a fishmonger called PJ Stoops, who was a wonderful guy who went around and basically took up all like the bycatch from the fishing boats, the bycatch being all the stuff that comes up. Also with the stuff that they do want. So they're wanting grouper and another different load of fish that just happened to be in the net. Quite often those things would be thrown back in the sea and those would die, etc. And my friend would, you know, give us all this fun stuff. So we had all these crazy, insane fish. And so again, we did like a lot of whole fish. That was our thing because, in my opinion, that tastes better, you know, anything on the bone like meat also. So this wonderful thing came together and we were doing, I used to spend most of my days off researching old English and European recipes from like 200-400 years ago and sort of adapting them to modern taste. I suppose a little bit Heston Blumenthal in some ways, because I really enjoyed those things. And then we would sort of probably put a little bit of a spin on it. But this beautiful thing, and it was a little old house. It was an old like 120-year-old creaky house with floorboards and a fireplace, and it was a tiny, tiny little rooms, and it was just a beautiful thing. It was just like a very quirky little restaurant doing quirky things.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Angela now. So let's just, you know, thinking of summer, what beer are you drinking? Because you're making me think about what kind of beer would go with barbecue and some other cooking.
Yeah, Angela here. I'm drinking the Schlenkerla Rauchbier Helles right now, which is one of my favorite breweries and beers of all time, which has that smoky characteristic because it's a Rauch beer, which I think is kind of perfect for the conversation, especially what you're talking about. And I'm just so incredibly excited when Richard, I heard you're going to be on and we're going to be talking about today. That's incredibly, incredibly cool stuff, especially when it comes to pairings. When it comes to barbecue, though, it's kind of funny. Most people will think, hey, those smoky beers would be perfect. But a lot of times when you have smoky character in the food, it can end up canceling that smoky characteristic in the beer. So I actually really love to, you know, what we call contrast with that and have something on the totally opposite end of the spectrum to really highlight all of that food. But just this particular realm of food, I'm very excited to talk about today.
Great. And what are some other beers that you might recommend just in general for these kind of summer pairings? Because when you said Schlenker Lahalas, I thought, well, I've had a couple Northeastern lightly smoked beers, like Kent Falls made a beer with a barbecue place in Connecticut called Besmoke, which is also like very subtle smoked ale. And Threes last year or two ago had the Short Fuse, which is also like a subtleness, very subtle smoke on yeah. Like a more of a session beer. Anything that else that you'd recommend that is or isn't a smoked beer to go with barbecue? Just to get us started talking about beer too.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, honestly, there's just been so many high quality sours coming out, especially with additions of fruit. And I find that savoriness, the saltiness, the roast, in contrast with fruit beers, fruit forward beers of many different varieties, can be just exceptional. If you're not in that mood, though, for something kind of maybe tart or a little bit sweet at moments, I mean, honestly, there's just been a whole other realm of phenomenal lagers that have been out in the market for a few years now, right? Because the pendulum's kind of always swinging in the beer industry, but it's thankfully for me kind of swung back into these classic Pilsner styles, like specific Czech Pils styles, a lot of Helles coming out. And of course, that's perfect for summer. It's not only great by itself for summer, but it could just be that perfect high carbonated beverage that you need to cut through all these big flavors. Because that's the thing at the end of the day with pairing. My favorite pairing tool is carbonation. And that's why I personally feel that beer is the better or easier pairer with food than say wine or other beverages, because it more readily has those bubbles to cut through what you're eating. And when we're talking barbecue and everything else, that definitely is a great way to go.
Great. And then also just next time we come back on, just tell us a few specific beers as well. And just go to Emery now. So Emery, I know that just tell us why you started a non-alcoholic beer brand.
Yeah, I started actually when I was pregnant with my daughter back in 2017. My husband and I were big kind of beer drinkers, and I was trying what was on shelf at the time and didn't care for the taste. So I set out to try to create something that tasted really good. So I'm drinking our Citrus Wheat right now. It's a perfect summertime beer, in my opinion. Goes great with this conversation of summertime pairings.
So right side.
Yes, Citrus, thank you. Right Wheat. Side brewing.
Okay, great. So Richard, now back to the, so it's summertime at the Feast or another Nose to Tail restaurant. First of all, what seasonings or any other influences did you get from Houston? Because I know Houston is one of the most multicultural cities in America.
I mean, we were sort of more heavily influenced by European, you know, herb spices. We used, you know, a lot of old spices like mace and bay and things like that, and nutmeg and that sort of thing, and a lot of fresh herbs. I mean, that was one of our main thing. Fresh herbs, on the whole, are very heavily abused, especially with chefs. They throw a bit on the end to make it look nice or put a bit of color on it. No, it's not for that. It's a layer. It's a layer. You put herbs in the bottom of a soup bowl, you pour soup in, boom, you get a beautiful floral thing. You know, you put herbs in a braise, it's going to be a very background thing. You know, later on, you put it in right on top at the last minute, it's going to be in your face. You know, it'll do amazing things. But I mean, we had a little bit of influence. I mean, Houston is an amazing place. It is what they call the melting pot. We have so many different cultural influences going on here. And to be honest, we didn't stray too down too far down any of those roads too much. We especially during the summer and things like that, we would go a little bit more sort of Spanish and things like that. We used to do even things like, you know, a good paella with rabbits and shrimp and, you know, giant paellas and stuff. You know, and pork bellies and things like that. You know, we just didn't stick to the totally weird. It was, you know, or unusual, shall we say. So we would mix it up a bit, but we were more about probably old school, you know, herbs, spices, influences, I would say, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So tell us a few things that might have been in that rabbit paella, and then we're going to ask Angela to come up with an actual beer to pair with it.
Oh, okay. I mean, you'd have, you know, perhaps some, obviously, rabbit, you'll probably have some like chicken thighs. Make sure you get a nice bit of chicken skin in there. Obviously, rabbit's ferociously lean, which is a problem with cooking rabbit. You've got to be a little careful with it. I mean, we would probably throw some like big old shrimps or prawns, you know, perhaps some little fire roasted peppers and chilies, some nice olives, obviously like saffron, lots of garlic, lots of rosemary. Rosemary's a really lovely one, I think, especially with the sort of rustic paellas. I mean, all those was good sort of hearty things. You know, good rustic flavors, I would say. A lot of fresh herbs, you know, although you know, you don't mess with the paella too much. And then like big squeeze of lemon all over the top at the end and a little bit more perhaps fresh herb, parsley, that sort of thing.
That sounds good. Angela, what would you pair with a dish like that without having tasted it?
Yeah, I mean, what I was mentioning before with those fruit-forward beers, I mean, an easier to get throughout the country kind of Creek Lambic, because, of course, we can find our local options, but Allagash is usually a pretty easily accessible brewery that can create, that creates several different creeks throughout the year or has, you know, various releases. But something like that would definitely be the direction that I would go in for sure.
Yeah. And a little more about you. Like, I know that you said one of the youngest certified Cicerones, but you've really worked your way up. I know that recently you did a lot of cheese and beer education.
Oh, my God. That's genius.
You like that? Cheers.
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. What were the challenges of getting an advanced Cicerone? Because you've really stepped up your game. And when I met you a few years ago, you'd first come to New York from Michigan. You were just trying to figure out New York. And you keep growing. So I'm a real fan of yours, just so you know.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, I lived in New York before, actually. I moved here when I was 18 and moved to LA for a little bit after that. And when I met my husband, actually, in Michigan, he was working at Founders Brewing Company. So he and I definitely connected and linked together, became our beer power couple, if you will. And so I was like, you know what? I really need to get back to New York City. I just missed the city so much. And so much had happened in those years in terms of the beer scene. So, yeah, I came back to the city with Advanced Cicerone under my belt. Again, some work in the cigar industry. Under my belt, and I'm forgetting the question. Oh my God, Jimmy, what was your question again?
Just, you know, those steps you had to take to become an advanced Cicerone,
and then
finding your way is the industry here.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Thank you for asking that. The advanced Cicerone exam is so different than the first two versions of the exam, right? You're definitely taking a big step up. So it's not just studying, reading, it's also manual, you know, working with your hands and really understanding how to work within the beer industry. So when you're being tested on brewing equipment, you're actually in a brewery walking around with a master Cicerone and they're just drilling you with questions. When you are being asked draft dispense questions, of course, my favorite parts, you're in a cooler and they've messed up the system and you have to go in and fix it kind of thing. It's hands-on and, of course, just sitting, writing just straight essays, no multiple choice or anything like that. So really trying to get towards a mastery or eventual mastery of each and every subject related to beer. What I personally love the most is how diverse all the different knowledge sectors were. It wasn't just like, oh, you have to know only about brewing. It's encompassing everything. So I loved that extra challenge personally, but you really have to want it to get to that level because it just involves so much. And thankfully a lot of beer drinking. So I'll tell you a fun thing I did for, oh my God, I can't believe it. For prepping for the exam is I'll be working at this cigar lounge running the beer program. And of course, when you have a cigar, it's pretty smoky and it's going to affect your whole system, your whole palate, right? So every morning at 10 a.m., my adoring, lovely husband would have this like 5-beer mini tasting flight set up, quizzing me on styles, like extremely, like very related styles. Like he would have like, say like a coffee stout next to an imperial stout next to a like a nitro stout, next, you know, all these slightly different but similar styles. And I'd quiz and go through and taste all of those beers and see if I passed or not, and then on to work. So it was just a really bizarre time of my life, but I was really glad to have the time to study and just learn all different aspects of the industry, if that makes sense.
No, that's great. Richard, let's pick a couple more dishes. Well, this is getting fun. How about this? I know Fergus Henderson, in one of his books, he's got this like the trotter that becomes, they call it, is it called trotter gear, where you just kind of slow cook?
Oh, trotter gear. Yeah, he used to sell it in like little packages. I believe it was based. You know, you could make like sauces, stocks out of it, and it was completely gelatinous, and so it gave the dish a sauce base in some ways, as far as I remember that thing. But yeah, I think he used to sell it. We used to do a lot of trotters. We used to stuff them with like chorizo and cilantro and a lot of fresh herbs and rice. So you basically split the foot. You take, you know, some of the meat out and the bits and pieces, and then you make a really nice stuffing mixture, put it all back in, tie it up, and then roast it in the oven in foil, which is wonderful. So you get all this wonderful aromatic stuff, and obviously the unctuousness of all the fat and stuff going on with the foot, which is wonderful.
Angela, what would you pair with something like that? You know, very gelatinous, fatty pork.
Yeah, that sounds to me like that fat needs to be lifted, right? Yeah, so honestly, it's not a typical lager style that you'll see, but if you do see it, I've been seeing a few more pop up, but a Zwickel, that Bavarian lager. So I know Urban Chestnut makes a great one. I don't know how necessarily nationwide, like accessibility-wise, you can get that beer, but if you see a Zwickel in your area, I personally do love the Urban Chestnut Zwickel. It's, again, a rare style, but it has just a little bit more malt backbone, almost this breadiness to it that I think would be standing up to such a dish, but also, again, that carbon dioxide, that carbonation can cut through something that's exceptionally fatty. I don't really like to go down the hop or IPA route with dishes like that because the fats, those oils of fat plus the hops, can make it really bitter, extra bitter in a way that's not as appetizing. So beware with hops and fattier dishes.
You know, you started mentioning carbonation and everything. Let's switch it to what can we expect now that COVID's wrapping up? Like during COVID, we all had so many cans and so many breweries rushed to make their beer in cans, and it was great. But then the last few months, I was just craving some really good draft. And unfortunately, I've been out in quite a few restaurants where I know they have a couple like high profile, you know, hard to get craft beers on draft. And I've been disappointed with the service. Either the temp isn't right, or there's just something off with the pour. And I know it's not the beer. So how do you see this, you know, recovery from COVID? And are there places that are rusty? Are there places that got lazy, not doing draft for over a year? What do you think's going on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been in deep conversations with my draft dispense contacts in Chicago and New York, and the same kind of things are happening is that these systems have been shut off for so long. Sometimes it's hard for them to start back up again, and you'll start discovering a lot of issues with temperature, with your beer pumps, you know, things just sitting. Maybe it wasn't cleaned properly because people, of course, were rushing out of their... I mean, I remember in Manhattan, that kind of weird terror weekend where everyone's like, I don't know what's happening. and everyone just kind of ran. So it makes complete sense that we're seeing so many issues. So these draft dispense companies are inundated with work. If actually I'm putting the call out, I'm specifically looking for draft techs or anyone who would like to work in the draft dispense arena, because I'm looking to put together educational programs to help guide people through that. That's something even beyond what, say, Micromatic offers or Perlick, because this is a really necessary part of the industry. And I think we're definitely seeing that now after COVID. So we're going to get some pretty gross lines right now. And unfortunately, it's going to be continue to be a tough fight, because a lot of times when retailers or these owners and bar and restaurant owners are faced with, hey, you need to clean your lines or make any changes or spend more money, it can be hard for them to see or realize or understand that they're actually losing money by not taking care of these issues. So that's why, I nerd out about it, because I see that the numbers are there. It makes so much sense to take care of it, but sometimes it can be a hard battle showing people why this math is not working out in their favor currently and how we could make it better.
Yeah. And now to Emery. So you're down in Atlanta. What are some of the summer foods that you're seeing and that you'd pair with your right side beers?
Yeah. So I think our wheat is really kind of our summer star. In Atlanta, we have, a lot of barbecue, but I think that's fresh in my mind after the 4th of July. But really, I think that lighter food goes really well just because our wheat's so light. So stuff like a summer salad or kind of a nice piece of grilled fish with lemon on it. That citrus complements the wheat really well. I would love to hear if, Angela or Richard have any pairing suggestions with just a really light American citrus wheat.
Angela?
Oh, man. Oh, there's nothing better. Is it more, would you say it's more German wit or like American wheat?
It's American wheat.
American wheat. So maybe a little bit more hop bitterness in the backbone, or not so much?
A little bit, not too much. It's pretty, pretty mild.
All right, cool. Yeah, just because like that does make such a big difference, right? Because people say wheat beers and then they'll try one like, oh, this isn't quite the wheat beer I was thinking of, because there's such a variety, which I obviously absolutely love. So something like that, I think you're spot on with the salad, even thinking cheese too, if you want to go in the caprese salad realm, a little bit of fat from the cheese actually could help tamp down a little bit of the bitterness, but work really well with that mouthfeel of the wheat itself. But honestly, you could even stand up to your to some sandwiches. I think that even or something particularly brioche or doughy. I don't know. That's kind of where my brain is going right now. Richard, what's it making you think then of?
Strange, I was thinking about on the same lines
in
a bizarre kind of way. I made up this recipe called pig's ear cake, which was basically sent through, I think it was a very vaguely Greek based, but we sort of adapted it for our needs, and it was wonderful. So it was like almost like a bready cake, and we used to make it in a loaf pan, and we used to like pre-cook the pig's ears, sliced up really fine, and then we would mix it with big with little chunks of ham and bacon, and then we would have a little bit of citrus, a lot of fresh herbs, and like dried fruit in there. So you'd have like a little bit of apricots and raisins and sultanas and stuff. So you've got a little sweet stuff going on, a little saltness in the background from the pork products, and some floral from the herbs. And then what we used to do is like we used to make it in a loaf pan and then literally slice it like a loaf of bread, put mustard on it and cheese, and then like grill it, broil it. So it's all this oozy, wonderful cheese, porky, cakey thing. I think that would go lovely.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, that sounds really good to me too. Keep going, Angela. This is good. I love it.
I think I'm glad that we both were thinking along the lines of like dairy in terms of cheese, because it has fat, yes, but that dairy, I mean, the dairy specific flavor can really, again, kind of calm things down. So that really comes in handy again if you do have even just ever so slight hot bitterness in the background there. I don't know about you guys, but I've been trying out more watermelon salads recently. I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. So feta, mint, watermelon, things like that. That might even be another direction I'd go in to really play up some other, especially citrus characteristics in that wheat beer. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Well, Angela, can you recommend an alcoholic wheat beer, American wheat beer that you like?
Oh my God, why am I so stuck on Allagash? No, I got to think of another one. I've been to cheese too long, you guys.
Allagash white, does that count?
It's you know what? Actually, theirs is more along the Belgian wheat beer varieties. Yeah. Let's see. I mean, like a classic, you know what? Even like classic, when people think of like classic American wheat ales, Bell's.
I was just going to say that.
Right? Yes. And I'm from Michigan, of course. So it's just people drink that like water all the time, that and Two Hearted. But that I think is like the epitome of classic American wheat that people think of with the Oberon and various other releases from them.
That's a good one. That's actually good. I'm going to get one of those this weekend if I can.
Yeah, it's a callback really for sure. Yeah.
Well, my point I'm getting to is I do feel you mentioned a couple in German styles. And I've always felt for years that many German style beer styles go great with so many different foods, and especially wheat beers. I think wheat beers are some of the best for food pairings.
We know a few things, says Germans, about beer right here. Yeah.
You hear that, Richard? Richard, what have you done any? Did you do any beer dinners at Feast over the years?
We did, and we used to have. Oh my goodness! We used to have a very sort of eclectic wine list and beer list, mainly put together through my ex-partner James, who did a lot of traveling and stuff. So we'd have, like a Spanish style lager, and then we had like Duval, and we had like some Sam Smith, and we had a wonderful sort of mixed array of quite a few different Spartan things like that, a few sort of lighter Pilsner type things to cut through the food and things. And people got into it a little bit, and it was very sort of all over the place. And yeah, we had no domestic wine or beer at the restaurant. It was all international and European.
Yeah. Well, we're off to a great start. We're going to come back in a few minutes and quiz Richard on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Uh-oh.
HRN is excited to unveil the new look of Food Radio. We have a new brand identity and a new website. Our site makes it easier than ever to discover new podcasts and dig through our archive of 16,000 episodes. It's been 12 years since HRN started broadcasting Food Radio, and we've made it this far thanks to the support of our global listening community. It's because of member donations that Beer Sessions Radio is on the air with 30 other weekly shows. Your contributions give HRN the security we need to stay on the air during the pandemic and are allowing us to reopen our studio. Becoming a monthly sustaining member of HRN shows how much you care about Beer Sessions Radio and Food Radio, what it means to you.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Congratulations, Heritage Radio Network team. There's a new website and logo. Thank you so much to everybody on the staff and the director, Katie Moseman Wadler. Check us out, heritageradionetwork.org. Become a member and support us. So what a show. It's summer. It's July 6th. It's like hurricanes are coming in, thunderstorm, even up here in the Northeast. There's like, I hear some thunder. But Richard, we're going to quiz Richard because, you know, he's one of our secrets. You're the reason for immigration, brother. We'll take English chefs who want to work in Houston because you've really been a prize. You came to Brisket King and helped judge some barbecue in New York City in April. So let's start with Emery and then Angela. Just come up with a flavor. It can be a flavor from a beer you know or some other flavor, or mention a beer you have. And let's see what Richard would pair with it. So Emery, why don't you go first? Something besides a citrus wheat.
All right. So we have an American IPA, which is kind of a West Coast style with some citrus notes to it as well. It's non-alcoholic with a little bit of hop there at the end.
We used to have a wonderful dish which actually got put forward in on TV by Frank Bruni, which was a wonderful honor. It was rabbit liver and kidneys on toast, which is wonderful. So basically we just pan fried those and make a little instant, like reduced, slightly sweet, meaty sauce with it. And then we'll just literally put that on some buttered toast, pour a little sauce over it. Beautiful, very meaty, very minerally, very slightly sweetness going on as well. Fantastic dish.
Yeah. Richard, you know, when I grew up, my grandfather was from the south of Italy and a real countryman, gathered his own mushrooms, right. But he cooked a lot of rabbit. The rabbit you cooked at feast, was that sourced in Texas?
Yes, that was. That was from our French friend, Sebastian Bonneau, who runs a farm just outside Austin called Countryside Farms. Wonderful, wonderful chef, real French character. I mean, so full on French. Has this wonderful farm, and so he used to supply us quite a lot of our stuff. He used to supply us like these giant ducks. I mean, these ducks, you've never seen anything like them in your life. I mean, they're literally the size of geese. They were ridiculous. They were, I mean, just you could get like four portions out of the two breasts, you know. And we used to get guinea fowl from him. And wonderful rabbits. And actually, me and a chef friend went up to his farm one day because, you know, we were all about the nose to tail stuff. But we were like, well, we should really put our money where our mouth is here and go actually see it firsthand. You know, we talk about it a lot and crap on about it. We should go and see what this is all about. And so we went there and we actually, you know, we killed some rabbits and processed them and skinned them and did all that and some ducks and chickens and things on the same day, which was, it was very eye-opening, but it was a good thing because we talked a lot of things about this, you know, a lot of time and energy into farms and, you know, farm to table and nose to tail. And we actually went up there and did it. We love rabbit. We did quite a bit of rabbit at feast. I mean, my famous dish is I'd like you to find a beer for this one. This would be a good one. So it was like a giant rabbit torpedo. So basically what I did was take a whole rabbit to make a wonderful sausage, fresh herb, dried fruit mixture. So like a very spicy, herby sausage. And then I would put that back into the cavity and sew it up like a football, basically. And then I would put giant sheets of suet pastry. So suet pastry is just pastry that's using animal fat instead of generally, I mean, you can use beef or pork, generally beef, and use that as the fat instead of the butter. And then I would literally close the whole thing up like a giant torpedo and roast the whole thing in the oven. So when you came out the other side, you presented to guests this whole giant thing and give them a giant cook's knife and say, go for it. And they would sort of like sword in the stone in reverse. You know, they'd like put the big sword in and the pastry would come apart and the rabbit and all the wonderful sausage meat came from inside. Yeah, wonderful dish. Love the rabbit. But it's very, very, but as I said before, it's very, very lean. So you really have to sort of be very careful with not being dry. So this was a wonderful way I came up with of actually, you know, getting the sausage and the fat inside and, you know, all part of it, what with that and the fatty pastry as well. Wonderful.
Yeah, it's been said that in some poorer countries that they were living off a rabbit, people would die of malnutrition.
Right. I'm sure.
Yeah, there's something you can't just live on rabbit alone, even though you might want to. Angela, so what would you pair with that? We'll go back to Angela pairing because that's a complex dish. It's almost like a meatloaf in some way.
Yes, in some ways.
All I know is that I'm very hungry now. That sounds so great. And by the way, I love that you're part of that whole process. It just it speaks to respect for the animal and for the process and what's happening and using each and every part. And it's really sad that that's not a bigger part of the conversation when it comes to food. So I think that that's remarkable. When it comes to pairing with that, you're right. Like there's so much happening. I'm actually even thinking the stout realm right now. Mm. Evil Twin definitely has like a whole series, but to be honest, they can get a bit sweet. So Brooklyn Brewing Company I'm constantly drinking their beer. It's a big go-to for me. Their Black Ops series, their Imperial Stout, I think for me, it's not it feels more like a classic stout, again, rather than a bunch of adjuncts or additions or lactose or anything else, because more often these days, especially locally, I'll see a lot of stouts in that realm. So I'd actually go down that path. That or do my very best to try and find a lighter-bodied standard stout nitrogenated. Because I don't know about you all, but that creaminess from the nitrogenated beer is one of my favorite things of all times, and I think would really do that dish.
So you mean like a nitro pour stout?
That would be preferred, personally. Yeah.
Do you have one that you can recommend for us?
Absolutely.
I mean, beyond Guinness, I'm trying to think of even like some local guys. Let me think here.
Have you had there's Rockaway out of Queens? Rockaway makes a black gold stout, yeah. I know because at Jamie's 43, we used to rotate. We always had a nitro stout on draft, and we basically sold one keg a week for 12 years. And there weren't a lot of choices, but Rockaway we rotated through quite a bit.
Wow, you really, you're right. There are very few choices, but that's awesome. I'm definitely going to seek that out then because I would prefer to drink that more often than I can currently.
Yeah, well, good. We're on the same page. I want to say, you know, for Angela, you really have come a long way, and I am proud of you because I know how hard it is to really grow in this industry. You know, for many of us, you know, there's jobs at the service level, but you've really gone above and beyond. And I want to give you a shout out. I mean, Murray's Cheese, which to me it was an important brand in New York City for a lot of things. Tell us about when you became their beer educator and exactly what you did. And maybe offer another one or two summer beer and cheese pairings.
So I managed their education program. It was really great, again, to see another side of the food and beverage industry and how incredibly related fermentation of cheese is to beer. So I think that they were definitely natural pairs. In that job, it wasn't just the beer side, which is kind of the best part, because not only could I do beer and cheese classes, but all these other kinds of classes, including making cheese itself, so mozz and burrata making, as well as putting together cheese boards and plates, which, man, that is a whole huge realm in the cheese world for sure. But understanding and knowing those skill sets and how to actually divvy up cheese properly and cutting techniques was very, very incredibly helpful. And of course, pairing. And I have a whole new level of respect now for wine. I finally was able to discover wines that really spoke to me. And that was a very exciting part. And even pairing weird things like Baijiu. the spirit baijiu, a wonderful Chinese spirit that was paired with cheese. And it was just one of the most bizarre things I've ever had in my life. So it was really exciting to be able to do that and be able to get that cheese side under my belt. And now bringing that back into the beer world has been incredibly, incredibly helpful.
What's a summer cheese, a style? It doesn't have to be a specific cheese, other than like a mozzarella or burrata that you can recommend.
Right, right. So there are Blue Meringue cheeses. And I feel like sometimes people are a little nervous about these Brie's and Camemberts that they'll see in this category of cheese called Blue Meringues. So this wonderful mold will grow on the outside of the cheese and essentially eat away at it from the outside in or break it down from the outside and move its way in. So that's where we get these super cream bombed, you know, those ones just oozing out. But I know that they can be kind of intimidating to eat at points, and they may not always just be cream bombs. Sometimes they're super mushroomy or a lot of sulfur characteristics or just smell like broccoli. So they can be exceptionally savory or they can be sweet cream and this just completely opposite end of the spectrum. So I think both ways that you find these Blue Meringue style cheeses, again, Brie's and Camemberts included in that category, you can find a lot of uses in summer. It does still scream a lighter character of cheese, even though it's very creamy. But you can pair it with fruit, which is, of course, very popular in summer. So like dipping kind of things for those more savory versions or like those kind of broccoli, sulfury kind of ones. They're perfect, actually, with various meats. So really playing up that savory side and just perfect for pairing in those kind of like in those settings when you're just having like quick grab and go sort of meats or things like that. So that's definitely a category again I really love, but again, there's two ends of the spectrum. So it can be kind of intimidating when people buy a cheese. They're like, oh, wait a second, this is way different than I thought it would be. So if anything, just make sure you talk to a cheesemonger when you're buying cheese, because it's all about what's fresh and what's ready and what's ripe, and especially that applies to those Blue Meringue style cheeses I mentioned. Wow. For example, by the way, if you look up a cheese called Cremant, that can be a really great place to start. Also, Latour, Latur.
All right, Cremant Latour. Now, Richard, you must be getting excited, right? We're talking about cheeses. What role did cheese play at Feast?
We went back and forwards with it a little bit. We found it, obviously in England, it would be a dessert. You'd have it last thing. And we, you know, tried it a little bit to start with, but we found it a hard push for American sweet at the end of the meal. We had a couple of wonderful dishes, which are old English thing. There's one called an Eccles cake, which is basically puff pastry. You make a little round disc, and then you make like a very sort of autumnal holiday mix of like raisins and currants and cinnamon and brown sugar and zest. You put that inside and you slash the top so you can see, open it, and then you bake it in the oven. Put a little sugar on top, caramelize it a little bit, and then you'd serve it with a really, really sharp cheddar, which is wonderful. You get that really sharp cheddar thing going on with the sweetness and then the pastry and then the zesty things going on inside. That was a really lovely thing. But yeah, on the whole, we found it a little bit of a hard push. We do have an amazing cheese shop here called Houston Dairy Maids, who do an amazing job, been around for a few years now. And they basically export cheese all around the country. They don't make cheese, but they have an amazing array that they pull from nationally, sometimes internationally. But so, we sold some, but it was still a little bit of a hard push.
That's really, I want to jump in really quick, Richard. I think that's really interesting that you're right. I think a lot of people eat cheese at the beginning of a meal, but that's not necessarily the case other places that you're going. And I mean, if Jim, you're asking about some more beers too, like the Mandarin Glow Up. It's a sour Berliner Weisse with, of course, Mandarin from Volksbier, something like that, where it has a specific tartness, not fully sour. And of course, a lot of big, wonderful fruit. That I could totally see, even with that Blumirein style I mentioned for like dessert. But I find it wonderful, I'm coming from a cheese side where I say, oh my God, dessert, cheese totally makes sense. I just thought that was interesting. You pointed that out, Richard, that that's not where everyone's brain is at all the time. But I think that cheese can be for every part of every meal.
Absolutely.
And you know, it is summer, but I was hearing, I'm sitting next to my window and there was thunder. Now you can hear the ice cream truck going by on the street. Love it here. Mm-hmm. But let's just switch to non-alcoholic beers because, Angela, I know you have a lot to say about it. And Emery, we've only done one show about it a year and a half ago. We did a dry January show with The Athletic. And Emery, you guys started in January. Angela, what is it about the NA beers? I know there's a role for it in most on-premise. I know that I'm always afraid to say the word non-alcoholic, and I like things like the German word alcohol-frei. Where does this fit in your whole lineup of things?
Yeah, I mean, I think it fits perfectly. And I think anyone who is really good at their job or pairings or anything else will already know and understand that it won't, like, alcohol is one aspect of the pairing. It doesn't make up the whole equation. So if you take out the alcohol, it may not have alcohol warmth that's coming into play or anything like that, but it doesn't mean that the pairing is lost. And so you can also bring in fantastic brewers who also don't turn their noses up at any beers. Like, no, this is another great realm of beer that we can create that should have all of the same big, bold flavors or, nice, easygoing lager aspects that we're all looking for. So I'm very much all about it. And again, like I mentioned earlier, carbonation's everything. So as long as there is a carbonation conversation when it comes to the beer product, that's going to be exceptionally helpful for me in a pairing setting. So I'm definitely all about it. I'm so, so glad that there's more options for people who just want to opt in or out or whichever way in between. Because I don't know about you guys, but I definitely even judge like bartenders by how well they can do an NA cocktail. Because if you really understand flavor, if you really truly understand how flavors work together in harmony to create something delicious, the alcohol shouldn't really honestly be a big factor there. You can still create something delicious without that. So I think it shows true skill sets when you can do it and do it well. I'm really excited about it, obviously.
Good. And Emery, what kind of feedback are you getting now that you're out in the market?
Yeah, we're getting great feedback. I think that, a lot of traditional beer drinkers, I think, kind of initially shy away from non-alcoholic beer because, you know, of kind of what people have perceived it to be up until recently. And I think once you get people trying it and tasting it, the whole reason I created it was to kind of have that craft experience, that premium and local experience, but just for the NA category. So really getting great feedback on taste. We try to remove the alcohol through filtration just in a much gentler way to kind of preserve that natural color and flavor and aroma of the original beer. So so far so good.
That's great. And now Richard, let's we're going to wrap up the show a little bit, but what's for dinner at your house? What are you eating and drinking?
Well, it's a strange one. I've actually started working for a tech Houston Texans athlete. And he has a very healthy, restricted diet, fish, eggs, and sort of beyond meat products. So actually, it's been rather wonderful because me and my wife was tending to make a little extra, and I'm eating a lot of beyond meat products, which I'm really enjoying.
You mean the brand Beyond Meat, or you're just,
Beyond. Yeah. I mean, I've been doing crazy stuff like, you know, traditional old stuff like shepherd's pie and even meatloaf and stuff. And you just basically, if you make it well enough, you can't tell. It's actually a pretty good product. And that, and doing some Indian, been doing a lot of Indian crossover meals also. There was a really interesting one I did for him last week, which was had sort of Italian sausage beyond meat style, but it was like Indo-Italian lasagna. And it had lots of crazy stuff going on. So, yeah, we've been doing a bit of that. And a lot of fresh fish. We've been joining him on the fresh fish front, which has been wonderful. Really enjoying it.
When you cook like a private chef gig like this, a top athlete, where do you cook? Do you cook at your kitchen and bring it over, or do you cook at that person's kitchen?
A little bit of both. So basically you do the basics at home, and then I go to his house every night, 5 days, and you do the last minute stuff.
Wow. Well, the Indian, I thought you might mention Indian food just because there's such great Indian food in London. What are some of the spices or preparations that stand out for you that if I had have three things that I would use to make it Indian, what would it be?
I mean, obviously garam masala powder, which is a wonderful thing for using for a base for most things. Coriander, cumin would be my ones. I mean, obviously use the whole seeds and then toast them. That's the key. If you smell like regular cumin ground from the store, and then you smell cumin that you've put on the stove and you've cooked out the seeds a little bit, toasted them, as they say, and then ground it fresh, totally different deal. Totally, totally different deal. Fresh ground seeds that have been toasted smell wonderful. They're wonderful. It's like chocolatey cumin. It really is. It's amazing, amazing flavor. Coriander the same. It's not quite the same. Never get ground unless you really need to, because doing it, toasting those spices yourself, even black peppercorns and things like that, if you can do that and just spin it in like a coffee grinder kind of deal.
Sounds like a good brewer. You got to have local malt and all that. Angela, last thing, with those flavors like cumin, fresh ground, toasted cumin, coriander, what beer would you give us before we go?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were talking Hefeweizen earlier, at least briefly. That's a classic, especially with Indian food, because it's one of those wheat beers that has actually big, bold flavor, not only like super highly carbonated and like very soft, creamy mouthfeel, but you can have notes of like bubblegum and smoke and light, of course, the light citrus, and like just all of these big kind of hitting you in the face sort of flavors in some ways, and yet still light on its feet. So when paired with exactly the spices that Richard was mentioning, we're going to have probably a really great combination no matter which Hefeweizen you grab. There is, of course, in my area here in New York City, there's the Grim Weisse, a local Hefeweizen, but there's the classics from local American breweries that have been around for like 15, 20 years, some of them. And of course, the classics from Germany, whenever you can grab a bottle.
Yeah. Besides Bell's and Grim, is there another, like a wheat beer that you can recommend? You said American classics.
Like one of the American classics?
Yeah.
You know what? Actually, something my brain, sorry, does immediately go to like a Chicago brewery that has become now nationwide known for their all classic German beers. But Dovetail, they're actually becoming kind of a standard. So their Hefeweizen, I would definitely say, really, really does the job better than almost any others that I've had.
Wow. Well, Angela, some of our listeners said we weren't talking enough about beer, so that's why I'm grilling you. So we got the Grim Weisse, the Dovetail Hefeweizen, some of the Bell's wheats like Oberon. In the stout categories, we talked about Brooklyn Brewery, the Black Ops. We talked about Rockaway Black Gold Nitro Stout. We talked about Folks Beer Mandarin Glow Up. That's one of my favorites. You mentioned Allagash Creeks. And then, of course, Zwickel, you mentioned Urban Chestnut from St. Louis. So we've covered it all. And we've got Emery, thank you for coming on from Right Side. I'm definitely going to try the citrus wheat and a beer. Thank you so much. And Angela, thanks again for all those great pairing suggestions.
My pleasure.
And good luck with another show we'll do, Angela, is talking about Draft Dispense and
Ooh,
all the work that
it.
You're doing. Because, yeah, we need to get our chops back and everybody's – hasn't really had to work on their draft systems for a while.
And yeah, if anyone, by the way, is interested in draft dispense or would like to have any, you know, any questions or troubleshooting, I'm all about that.
Yeah, and what's your Instagram, Angela?
Oh, right, my Instagram. Man, I'm the worst millennial. Like, never download Instagram anymore. Style Symposium. It's like my last name, Style. It's like Stein, but with an L.
All right, we'll find it. Style Symposium. And we know Emery is right side. And then Richard, he's that crazy R something night. But Richard, thank you so much, my friend. It was great meeting you at the Brisket King event. Really appreciate your interesting perspective, nose to tail, European food, cooking in Houston. And you perked me up. I'm going to go toast some cumin seeds. You got to get some cumin seeds.
Good. Yeah, I need to see that on Friday night. Yeah, for your Friday night deal. I want to see some Indian stuff. Come on.
We'll get it, brother. All right, guys. Thanks so much for joining me, Angela Emery and Richard. Thanks to our engineer, Armin Spengen, our assistant producer, Caroline Fox. I'm Jimmy Carboni. And thank you so much to the Heritage Radio Network team. Congrats on a great launch of the new logo and website at heritageradionetwork.org. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo! Okay.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.